When it comes to mediumship and our understanding of our ability to talk to the deceased, well, we've come a long way from this.
I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
That is the 1999 movie, The Sixth Sense, which, if you've never seen it, it's really a great movie, and that little quote there has a very interesting twist. So those of you who've seen the movie know, those of you who don't, check it out. But we've come a long way from that to, well, this.
My uncle.
But is your dad departed?
My dad is
okay,
departed.
Okay, because there's like a crap load of spirit here right now. I didn't mean to say it like that, but I don't know who to start with. They're all lined up on the stairs over there.
And if you didn't recognize her, that's Teresa Caputo, reality TV star of the reality show Long Island Medium. Unfortunately, when it comes to real scientific research into mediumship and what might be going on and how it might be affecting everyone involved, both the medium, the one who's trying to connect, and the one they're trying to connect to, if we can include them in the equation, well, we still don't know enough. Of course, that's why we have Dr. Julie Beischel from the Winbridge Institute joining us today.
I'm really worried they're medicating young children as schizophrenic because they're saying they're hearing voices. We try and take what we know and provide it to different audiences. So researchers, I know how to speak researcher. And so we're working hard on trying to take this information and convey it in a way that the general public, it's good for them. Clinicians, so they know about the reality. Like I was at a conference with clinicians once and I talked to one woman and she was tremendously surprised that the mediums on our team don't walk up to people in the grocery store parking lot and give them messages. No, that's completely unethical. Our mediums don't do that.
This was a fun interview with a great guest. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Julie Beischel. Today we welcome Dr. Julie Beischel to Skeptico. Julie is the co-founder and director of research at the Winbridge Research Center, which really is the preeminent organization for the study of mediums and mediumship in the world. And as we just talked about for 1 hour, because I forgot to press the record button, there's really two sides to saying that. There's a good and a bad side that this little research center that Julie has started and kind of nurtured along for so long is really the best there is in the world. It's a great testament to her and what she's done, but it also is a little bit of a statement about where we are in general in trying to get a better handle on survival and consciousness studies that kind of go against the mainstream neurological model that is rigidly holding on to its position. So Julie is also, I should mention, the author of several books related to this topic that you can find on Amazon. And she's just a great guest and a great friend. Julie, welcome back to Skeptico for a third time, because we just did an interview a minute ago.
Yeah, we did. It was a lovely hour we just spent together. I'm pleased to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, it is. And now, so you took all the venom out of me, so now I have to be nice this time too. So I guess that's the price I must pay. So as I told folks, you know, the real impetus for this interview was that I got an email from you about this organizational change at Winbridge that I think is kind of interesting to tell people about, because the refocus that you have is really wonderful, I think, in some important ways. So let's start by, first of all, before we jump ahead into that, for folks who don't know, tell people a little bit about yourself, about your background. A lot of people know because they've listened to Skeptico before or because they've just heard you other places. But for those who don't, give us the rundown on who Julie is and how you came to do this work.
Okay. I am director of research of the Winbridge Research Center. and which my husband is the executive director, and the two of us, his name is Mark Bacuzzi, the two of us founded the Wimbridge Institute LLC 10 years ago, and we had a lot of different interests, and we were we spread ourselves a little too thin. And so we wanted to focus on what we were good at and what we were really interested in. And so we started this Arizona nonprofit corporation called the Wimbridge Research Center. And we're focusing specifically on research and education around dying, death, and what comes next.
And Julie, I know you've told this story a million times, and you don't have to tell the whole story, but I think people are always fascinated by the story for how you came to even be interested in this. And since what's so wonderful about what you do is the scientific rigor that you bring to this work, I think people are interested to know that you're a PhD, and not only you're a PhD, but you're a PhD trained to kind of figure out strange phenomenon like this and kind of wrestle it to the ground. So a little bit about your background might be useful.
Okay. My PhD is in pharmacology and toxicology with a minor in microbiology and immunology. So my training is in the hard sciences, and I know how to apply the scientific method to anything. So the science is a tool. It's not a set of beliefs or a set of facts. So you can apply it to anything. And so when I was in graduate school getting my PhD, my mom passed away, and I'd never heard of a medium. But that was around the time that John Edward was on TV. His show was really big. So I thought, well, that looks real. Those people look moved. And the information seems specific, but I'm a scientist. I need to see that for myself. So I got a reading from a local medium, and she knew things that there was no way that she could have known. And I knew about cold reading. I'd read up on it. And so I knew what she could learn just by seeing me. And but she said a lot of things there's no way that she could have known, and even things I didn't know that I had to check with other people in my family to verify that were true. And there's a even weirder story that someone came in who I didn't know, and like a couple years later, I ended up dating a guy, and he recognized that guy from my reading. So there was like forward and backward in time issues. It was very interesting. And so I went back to school, and I talked to the other students and my professors, and I told them about this experience that I'd had. And like good scientists, most of them said, oh, I don't know anything about that, but that sounds like an interesting experience, and you're clearly moved you. But a couple of them went, nah, those people are all frauds and con artists. You got duped. And I was like, no, I didn't. I'm a good scientist. I was there. And I started to realize, yeah, there's a huge movement of people who don't know anything about it and just have heard that and just parrot it back. Oh no, they're all frauds. And so I was like, that's not fair. And these people need a good scientist to apply the scientific method and bring this into the lab. That's what they really need. And the universe was like, really? Here you go. It's you now. And so the universe conspired to put me on this path. And I've been doing it ever since. And so my training is in hard science. And so I can, I'm good at protocol design and blinding and control groups. And I can design the heck out of a study. And that's
you have. And one of the things, one of the reasons that I think you're so popular on Skeptico is because our audience is very scientific minded. And I think a lot of people are just blown away by the rigor that you applied. And, you know, the gold standard really for medium research, as some folks have called it, and anyone who gets in there and looks at it knows that's the case. And you can go look at some of the interviews we've done with Julie in the past, and they stand up to all this kind of nonsensical, silly, skeptical kind of crap that's out there. And she just destroys them. She just destroys them over and over again by good science. Isn't that what we really want after all? But you know what I was really struck by, and I wanted you to speak to, is I love what you've said here. about the Wainbridge Research Center, because when we get past the battle of consciousness, you know, and is consciousness a product of the brain? Are we biological robots? And then we say, on a deeper level, you know, what is the deep spirituality associated with mediumship? And by that, I mean, how does it really affect people's lives in a positive way? And I was really quite taken by the mission statement that you've written for Wainbridge Research Center. And I love to ease suffering around death, dying, and what comes next. And I just felt myself like exhaling and going, yeah, there's a lot of suffering around this. And wouldn't it be cool if science, if rigorous scientific research could actually alleviate some of that suffering? So talk to us for a minute about this mission statement and what it means to you and why you chose those words.
Well, first, I'm very detail oriented, and I never liked the way that it was often said death and dying, because dying comes before death. So I put them in chronological order, dying, death, and what comes next. And I feel like sometimes I'm not a channeler, I'm not a medium, not a psychic, but sometimes phrases, in parapsychology, it's called anomalous attention, that something comes by you and you say, that's meaningful, like that's going to be something. And I don't know where I heard it, in a movie, in a book, what comes next. And I grasped onto that. I thought that was really a good way to describe, because we're interested in what happens next for the person that died and what happens next for the living that are still around and grieving that loss. So we wanted to use rigorous scientific research to collect data and make conclusions that we then could share with a variety of audiences.
And let me just interject for a minute, because, you know, you say that just because that's second nature. That's who you are. I mean, that's PhD pharmacology and toxicology, right? But it's different. It's different in this field. You bring that here in a way that's really important. And as I was relating to you a minute ago, that really struck me from a long time ago, from years ago when I met you, is that, and especially into the gender differences thing, but especially guys, you know, guys, a lot of times we need the data, you know, we need the data, and then we feel that we can kind of maybe venture into some of those feelings that we have if we have the data. And I love that, you know, that's not just, that's something that you obviously had a certain affinity to, as well as the science and the data, as a way to kind of move forward. So talk about that for a second.
So as a society, we rely on science to move forward. It drives policy. It's what medications are allowed. Like, that's all science. What foods are in the world, what things are how we eat food, what's suggested. So clearly our society holds science as an authority. And yeah, I've always had a predilection for science. When I was in eighth grade, I won the science award in my class. So I have always been a scientist. I don't know how to think any other way. Right. And that's so when I had a question, when my mom died and I was seeing mediums on TV, I used science to get to the answers to my questions. But science is just one way of knowing, and people's experience, that's another way of knowing. And so, but I'm a scientist, so I use my method, and that's what I can share with people, our data. And that does convince people, and that does help people and alleviate suffering for some people, to know that I brought mediums into the laboratory and I controlled for all the things that people could say, oh no, it's just this. Like, no, I controlled for all of that. They have no access to the sitter during the reading, so they can't do cold reading. The sitter receives two readings to score. One is theirs and one isn't. They don't know which is which. So the rater bias is equalized. I don't know anything about the deceased or the sitter, so I can't cue the medium. So all of those things are taken care of, and it still was happening. They still could do it. And so we published a paper a couple years ago where 20 mediums performed 58 readings, and the accuracy data reached statistical significance, three different kinds of accuracy scoring, item by item scoring, whole reading scoring, and forced choice, pick which reading of those two you think is yours. So there's clearly something going on, and that helps people like yourself and like me go, oh, okay, there's something going on here. This is a real phenomena.
It also helps the people that should know about that and we trust with telling other people about it, right? So that's the other part of your mission is sharing that information, not just with the general public, but that's something you do, but also sharing it with healthcare providers, sharing it with nurses, doctors, sharing with, you mentioned Indigo, I thought was just an excellent point. And maybe we'll bring it up to the front of this interview, but to think about that situation that we all know that exists, and that's that someone loses someone. They're in grief, and yet they feel that person's presence. They hear that person, and they go, oh my gosh, what's wrong with me? They go see a mental health care professional. Oh my gosh, I can only hope we're past the point where that person says, oh my God, you're crazy. Even whether they say it directly or indirectly, and they say, take this medication. We have to get this information out there. We have to stop that from happening, right?
Yeah. And like, you know, and I'm really worried they're medicating young children as schizophrenic because they're saying they're hearing voices. Like we need, like we are, we try and take what we know and provide it to different audiences. So researchers, I know how to speak researcher. And so we're working hard on trying to take this information and convey it in a way that the general public, it's good for them, clinicians, so they know about the reality. Like I was at a conference with clinicians once and I talked to one woman and she was tremendously surprised that the mediums on our team don't walk up to people in the grocery store parking lot and give them messages. No, that's completely unethical. Our mediums don't do that. That they agree to a code of ethics and that including you don't provide information to someone who didn't ask for it because you don't know if they're ready to hear it. That's a very big concept to get your head around and the grieving person might not be ready for it. I've heard mediums say that in a grocery store line, the deceased were like, you have to tell my wife this message. And the medium saying, no, I don't, I'm not going to do that. You're going to have to encourage her to ask me what I do for a living. That's as far as I can go, but I'm not going to like tap your wife on the shoulder and say, I have a message for you. So there are things about what mediumship really is in the real world that's different than how it's portrayed on TV, for example, and people don't know that and clinicians don't know that. And so I'm really worried that people are being medicated for mediumistic experiences when it's very common. And after, yeah, I think that one of the big things is after death communication with a loved one is very common. And people think it's weird, but it's very common. And so again, that even that little nugget, like, oh no, that totally happens. You're not weird at all. That alleviates suffering right there. And then that makes the person more open to it the next time. And it's comforting the experience rather than it being stressful, like, oh no, it's weird, I'm crazy, I'm turning psycho. No, it's very common. After death communication is very common. And so we're trying to convey those kinds of facts and that evidence-based information to the public and to all these different audiences, clinicians. And then we use the word clinicians for mental health and healthcare providers, and we use the word practitioner for mediums and psychics because they also need to know, and it can alleviate suffering in them. The kinds of things we learned, like one of the mediums on my team, I was talking to her the other day, and I was telling her about this, the results of the study, and that we did a study where we had 122 self-identified mediums describe their experiences during communication with the deceased and during psychic readings for the living. And they, as we've learned in research with just the mediums on our team, just a few of the mediums on our team, it seems to be a what we call multimodal experience. So they see things, they hear things, they smell things, they taste things, they feel things. And so I was telling the medium that, and she was like, oh, I thought it was everyone was just clairvoyant. It was just visuals, just seeing. And she like felt comforted. I was like, how do you not know that being in my research team? But we, you know, she's not reading my research papers. So we need to be able to convey this stuff to different audiences in different ways so that it alleviates suffering for all the different segments of the who we're serving. We're a charity. We're serving people.
And yeah, so you're serving those different groups. I'm glad you clarified that, because we're going to talk more about that in a minute. You know, you were speaking a minute ago to me about, I don't know if it was the same study or another survey that you did that had some rather amazing findings to it that kind of clarify for people. I think the example you gave me was that most people,
Do you want me to say it?
Well, what I heard you say, let me tie it back to it. I'll edit all that out. Because what I really wanted to say is, I think that highlights maybe the need that you're trying to serve and the need that you have right now, which is to get funding for this project. Because who else is going to do this kind of research? I mean, the research you just talked about, we just highlighted a couple of reasons why it's so necessary.
One data point. Like the things that we've learned in this survey study are amazing. We did an online survey. It had multiple parts. Some of your listeners may have participated in it. It was called the Octo study, the SAM study, and the Cinco study. And the Octo study, we collected online data from 1,300 people, 1,000 people who were not mediums and 300 people who were mediums. And then those people were invited to participate in the SAMS and the Cinco studies. And we collected even more information. And we learned some really interesting things. Like I was really surprised even by some of it. One thing being, we took those descriptions that those mediums gave of the communication with the deceased and then psychic readings for the living. And we use computerized text analysis to quantitatively analyze their responses. And we use content analysis to qualitatively analyze their responses. And we have a paper coming out detailing those results. But one of the really interesting things was even when they were describing psychic readings for the living, their experiences included communication with the deceased. So, and often it was just, they didn't say it like this, and I don't mean to be flippant, it was like random deceased people. It was not people that were associated with the sitter or that even the medium knew. It was people sort of passing by, like, oh, here's some information about this living person that you're talking to. And so
just to clarify for people, you know, there's always been this kind of divide between psychics and mediums. And what you're saying there, I think, in short form is the lines are much blurrier than that. Psychics are running across spirits all the time. And, you know, a minute ago we talked about, I mean, more evidence piles up that the kind, if you want to get real sciencey about this and try and understand it from a super psi or a big glob of consciousness, more and more of the evidence of your evidence seems to point to there really are some kind of there's some kind of reality to this. I know you didn't like the extended consciousness realms kind of thing, but these spirits are out there, right? I mean, what do you make of that?
I don't think that it needs to be something that like you really have to shift your worldview. Like your existence is that you are in this meat bag. And so the data show that we're really only tenuously tied to our body. Like they've done research with VR goggles and they put the camera on a mannequin. And so when you look down, the camera looks at the mannequin. And if someone stabs the mannequin, you have an adrenaline response. It's really easy for you to convince your brain, your mind, like, oh, no, we're over here now. Like you only think you're in your body because you're receiving constant feedback that you are. But it's really easy to fool the mind into thinking that you're somewhere else. So we're very like loosely tied in here to begin with in our regular life. So you're just going to be you. You're just going to be not in your body anymore.
Yeah, that's tough because that touches on so many. Let me ask that question. I mean, what does that say about so many spiritual traditions that are telling us exactly that. Particularly the Eastern yogic traditions are saying exactly that you, this reality that you form inside your head by this constant stream of thoughts is easily dismissed by any kind of careful analysis, any kind of meditation that realizes you are the observer. I mean, this is kind of basics of a lot of Eastern spiritual traditions. It, in a way, you seem to be kind of pointing in that direction as well.
Yeah, and I think in the Eastern traditions, a lot of times meditation focuses you into your body. Like, clearly it implies we're in this life to be in this body, to have this experience, but it's not, that's not the end of it. But there are other traditions where the meditation is to like forget that the body exists and sort of be released from the body. I think it sort of all plays into your consciousness and, right. Like dreaming, that's a altered state of consciousness that people have regularly. Like, you have activity and, you know, there's a plot and you met people and you saw things and you did things and you wake up and you go, yeah, none of that happened. Yeah, no, it didn't. And I don't know, I won't say that because maybe it did, right? There are people who think the dream reality is a real reality, and I don't have any evidence that it isn't.
Well, the problem with that is lucid dreaming kind of falls right in between those two lines there and starts blurring it, as does, you know, astral projection and channeling, which is really weird and stuff like that. But then there's some bordering on scientific evidence that that's real too, or that that can stand a certain degree of scientific scrutiny. So there's all these aspects to consciousness that are just waiting to be explored once we get past this rigid idea that it has to be cranked back into the body and be one
piece of brain. And I am interested in all of them, but to be good at it, I have to pick one and I have to study that. So I've been doing mediumship and life after death survival of consciousness research for 10 years, probably close to 15 now. And that's what I'm good at. And I'm going to keep doing that. And with the purpose of alleviating suffering, because at the, you know, there's a lot, like, you can spend hours in philosophical discussion about what's going on, but at the end of the day, we're interested at the Winbridge Research Center in how can it help people. And that's the bottom line. And that's what we're trying to serve people, and we're trying to answer those questions. And there's no funding for these kinds of things. And so we're really relying on public support to be able to continue doing what we're doing. And so I encourage people to join our email list at winbridge.org. I think we're going to start to offer memberships in 2018 and have members will receive priority first access to research findings, and we'll do online member only online events where with researchers and mediums, and people can ask questions live. And so if people would like to be notified of those kinds of things, and I'm forgetting what I talked to you about in the first hour and what I talked to you about this time. So please join our email list and be notified when we're putting up new videos and fact sheets and papers and all kinds of things.
Again, you're in such a unique position. I just really hope people support this, because it has to continue and you have to continue doing it.
Well, thank you.
Let's talk about where mediumship is fitting and evolving into the mainstream culture, because, you know, there's two ways of looking at it. One is people go, mediumship, I know that's so accepted now. You know, there's the Long Island medium, there's all these other shows, there's all these, we accept it, right? And yet at the same time, there's a scientific community that doesn't accept it. And you've made some headway in that area too. You know, one of the things I pulled off your website is you did this kind of neat little interview session at Goop, which is Gwyneth Paltrow's super high profile and successful webpage, lifestyle health lifestyle thing. So In some ways, it's the good news, bad news. And some of the questions were very basic, you know, and we're kind of way back to the beginning. But you did a nice job of answering those. So what do you think about mediumship and its acceptance by the mainstream? Whether that's happening as fast as you thought, or just any thoughts you have on that?
I think a lot more people know what a medium is now because it is appearing in the popular culture. I think the problem with that is they have a skewed idea of what a medium is and does, because all they're seeing are how the mediums are portrayed on TV, which does not reflect how it works in reality. And but at least...
Well, so what do you mean when you say that? What are some of the things that jump out when you say it's not how it works in reality? Because again, let's remind people, you work with mediums a lot, you know, and that's giving you this kind of unique perspective on both the misperceptions and the misconceptions that the general public has about mediums. But I also found fascinating what you touched on a minute ago is the misconceptions that mediums have about both the work that they do and the work that other mediums, other their colleagues do. So you had some interesting thoughts on that. Do you have anything more to add?
Yeah, I think the survey study results are going to be really interesting. I was surprised by a lot of them. One being, we asked the question, do you charge for readings? And 30% of the mediums who responded said, no, I don't. I was really surprised by that. I thought that like the mediums on our team were representative of the general population. And I don't think that's entirely true. And yeah, I say people don't know how mediumship works in the real world. And neither do I. I know how it works in the laboratory. But I'm not like spending time with mediums, or I only ever got one mediumship reading in my life. So I know how it works under the microscope. And I've talked to them, and I know, I've heard their frustrations.
But what are some of the misconceptions that people have about how it works, even under the microscope? I mean, you mentioned a minute ago about telling a medium, explaining to a medium that not everyone was clairaudient, you know, and that was surprising to them. I mean, what are some of the things you found out about how mediumship works in the lab that mediums found surprising?
Well, most of the mediums on our team were interested in becoming research mediums. Like our testing, our certification is not just to like test mediums and give them a stamp of approval. We wanted to gather a team of mediums that we could do research with, and that they understood research and they were interested and they could help us with protocol design. Because a lot of times I send an email and I go, hey, we're thinking about doing this. Do you do this? And they go, no, but we could do this. And they give me alternatives of the way that we could study what they do in a way that they could do it. So that's really helpful to really understand. But most of them are on the team because they have questions too about what's happening to them and how they can do what they do and how the brain is involved and, you know, those kinds of things. And a lot of them were excited to be on a team of other people who have experiences similar to theirs, because some of them, you know, live their lives being an oddball and no one understanding their experiences. And so to be part of a team that the sole purpose is to learn more about what you do, that was really encouraging. That alleviated suffering in them, I think. And,
you know, one of the things you talked about the last time you were on, and I wonder if there's any update on that, is that there's even a physical dimension to that that you discovered that I think is probably going to be surprising to people. Do you have any updated information?
You mean about illness?
The physical effects, either the pre-existing that somehow might be related to their mediumship or that comes as a part of being a medium. I mean, there's some physical differences, medical differences you found. Is there anything you can tell us about that?
So a number of the mediums on our team have, having an autoimmune disorder myself, I recognize it. And so they would say, a lot of them on our team have autoimmune diseases as well. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Is there something about mediumship that's causing disease. So we did a study where we drew blood and we took physiological measurements of mediums doing readings and then doing a control condition. And we looked like, is there something that, is their blood pressure changing even? Is anything changing in their blood? These different blood, I think we looked at like 30 blood components. Like, is anything changing? And what we found was nothing changed. Mark joked, you could have had a political discussion, a heated political discussion with someone, they would have had a bigger physiological response than we were seeing. So it wasn't any change. So then it made me think, well, why do they have this higher disease prevalence then? And so we asked, when we did the big survey study, we had a lot more mediums, 200 mediums answering these questions. They also showed a lot higher incidence of autoimmune disorders and all kinds of disease processes. And what I'd been learning about when all of this was happening was that childhood trauma causes disease in adults. And that's been well established just in the general population. Childhood trauma results in adult disease. And so I wanted to see, well, is that what's going on? Because it doesn't seem like the mediumship readings in and of themselves are maybe causing the problems. Is it a history of abuse? And so we gave the mediums in the survey study a childhood abuse scale, and they scored off the charts. So I'm not the first person to say that. There have been other people have talked about this relationship between child abuse and psychic abilities, and there are theories about why that is, that because you lived in an abusive situation, you had to learn to know when danger was coming, when there was no sensory way you could know that. And you had to, and a lot of times abuse is associated with dissociation. So maybe you learned how to achieve an altered state that made you more receptive to be able to hear from the deceased. Someone asked me in a seminar once, does adult abuse also result in, and I was like, no, don't go out and get in an abusive relationship so you can be a psychic. That it doesn't work like that. But there does seem to be this relationship between, like in this survey study, the people who identified as mediums scored statistically higher in this childhood abuse scale than did people who identified as not mediums. So there seems to be at least a relationship. I don't know if there also was this higher incidence of disease. So I think maybe it's not that mediumship causes disease. It's that trauma causes mediumship and trauma causes disease. That's my hypothesis at this time.
Working theory, as it were. Which is kind of interesting because it kind of touches on something we talked about a minute ago in the last interview, and that is the relationship between parapsychology, which is the closest thing we have to scientific legitimacy in this area, and survival research. And those lines are getting blurred. I mean, your work is blurring those lines because you, as you said, are doing a little bit of an end run on parapsychology. Not that you don't get along with those folks or like and respect them, but you really don't fall under that category, nor do you fall under the category of near-death experience, although it's closely related because it, again, touches on this question of survival, nor do you fall under, you know, we're talking about the work at University of Virginia and Jim Tucker and his past life work, which directly speaks to this question of survival. So maybe you want to spend just a minute and talk about how all these things might relate. And then I have a following question about that that relates back to the medical part and maybe causes us to take another look at this biological robot thing. But first, you know, how does what you do fall into the larger question of survival? And I've just brought up on the screen, you know, Leslie Kane, who I did an interview with and has written this very popular book, which tries to mainstream this idea that survival is something that we can now accept, we can kind of step into and talk about in an intelligent, intellectual way among those kind of folks. And, you know, what do you think about the broader question of survival and how that's being brought into the culture, accepted by the culture?
Well, yeah, I don't consider myself a parapsychologist. And traditionally, Parapsychology is described as studying the big four, telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, and psychokinesis. And then the late, great transpersonal psychologist, William Broad, once wrote, you know, that parapsychology is interested in the big four with an occasional nod to survival and afterlife topics. So even in parapsychology, it was fringe. And yeah, I and as a community, we try different labels for ourselves. And right now I'm liking a consciousness researcher. I think that's probably more descriptive because I'm not doing the big four. I don't study the big four. I study survival of consciousness. So consciousness researcher seems to be a better term. And I think that the evidence for the analogy's been used, it's like the idea of the bunch of sticks. So in any one of these, we call them the planks in the survival platform, near-death experiences, children who remember past lives, mediumship, out-of-body, all of these things, any one of them, there are flaws to the body of data. But if you hold them, you can break any one stick. But if you hold them all together, you cannot break the bundle of sticks. So I think that's been well established, and that the issue with it not having a secure foothold in the world is simply a reflection of human psychology. It's people are not good at new things or changing their mind, and especially people who sort of their personality is amygdala based, where they new things they are experienced as dangerous, so they are physiologically, neurologically incapable of being like calm and open minded. If you have a conversation with people about this topic and they yell, they're not frontal cortex having a discussion with you. They're amygdala responding out of fear and anger at these new things. So there's a lot of that in the world where we're never going to convince some people because it's just too physiologically, neurologically dangerous for them to contemplate these things that I'm talking about.
Do you have any thoughts, Julie, on what role technology might play in getting us to the next level here? You know, I just did an interview with UFO researcher, Stan Truman, and you know, the UFO intersection with this is kind of interesting in that same extended consciousness realm. But one of the things that's challenging about this is that there does seem to be a technology angle right around the corner. Even when we approach it from a scientific angle, you know, you take remote viewing, which we kind of accept. Again, they took a scientific double-blind approach to psychic work and were able to be effective at it. What happens when we go to the next level and we use brain mapping and some of the advanced neurological technique to kind of get us beyond where we're at now? And there's these kind of tantalizing evidence that technology might bring us closer to some form of communication with these extended consciousness realms, if you will. Do you have any thoughts on what role technology might play in the future in terms of changing how we think about this, or making it, I guess, ultimately, not just changing how we think about it, but making it more effective? What happens when your iPhone 20 can do telepathy? I mean, what kind of future is that?
Well, I think it actually goes the opposite way. Like, that's a question I get all the time. Like, well, what happens in a medium's brain? But if we're talking about the opposition theory to scientific materialism is non-local consciousness, which is consciousness exists everywhere and all throughout space and time and is just funneled through the brain like a radio antenna. So that, like, why are we even worried about the brain anymore? It doesn't seem like that's where we are. And like we talked about this sort of Venn diagram of mediumship and psychic experiences. And there's a lot of overlap, so if you did brain mapping and brain imaging, which is admittedly a study I've always wanted to do, is looking at mediums' brains during various situations,
Well, but you're familiar with Michael Persinger. I mean, Michael Persinger up in Canada, he's kind of taken it at a different level. He's, and a lot of people aren't familiar with his research, but he's not only mapped the brain, but he said, okay, telepathy, here's how we do it. And he sent the message from here to here with electromagnetic stimulation. And again, it's, I'm with you, you know, but the lines do become blurry in a way I've been more open to lately in terms of understanding that we have to appreciate that technology is probably going to have something to say about how we think about this in the future. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts on what that merger might be.
What just came into my mind was, you know, what we know about how to be more psychic is meditative practices. And I think Americans are often like they don't like to hear that because meditation, people have trouble clearing their mind, but that's not what meditation is. Meditation is about focusing on something, and the mind does not like to be clear. It has jobs to do, and telling it to shut off, it's not pleased with that at all. And so focusing, counting your breaths. So I think where technology might come in is sort of in this consciousness hacking movement of technology helping us to learn how to focus and breathe and count, and so that we can have access to those other realms, if that's the phrase that you want to use, or this these other, that your consciousness can learn to be more non-local, that it can learn to access this information that's separate from you locally. I think maybe that's where technology, but we had talked about this earlier, about the measurement of things, like that's a lot of what these systems do, the physical measurement of things, and these aren't physical things anymore. And there's a lot in the body that we don't understand, right? The body is very efficient. It doesn't do things. It doesn't waste energy on things it doesn't need to. But every cell since the beginning of time, every human cell that has divided has spent the time and energy and resources to replicate the DNA in its entirety for the new cell. But 97% of that DNA doesn't do anything. It doesn't code for any proteins, but we're still keeping it around. So is it like a homeopathic issue, or the energetics of the DNA is holding some information that doesn't have a physical manifestation? So there's lots of things that we already know in biology and in other fields that you can't measure those kind of things, but they continue to exist. And, you know, lots of phenomena that we can't explain, why we yawn, why we dream, why we blush. We don't understand that, but those are common experiences that people have. And so, you know, there's this idea of like, we have to embrace mystery at some point too. We might not be able to measure everything or bring everything into the lab or image everything or count everything. And that's part of human experience. It's important.
I think that also speaks to something you mentioned early on, and that's why we need people to focus on one thing and do it really well. And that, I guess, is really what you're trying to do it at Winbridge. So tell people more as we wrap up about what is coming up for you, what do you think is important on the horizon, what you want to accomplish with some of the near-term research that you're working on.
Well, our overall arching mission is to alleviate suffering. And so we're using rigorous scientific research and then sharing the results of that research with different audiences, clinicians, researchers, the general public, practitioners, in a way that benefits them and alleviates suffering. In that, like, mediums need to know about common things. Like, you're not weird. This is how other mediums experience it. And, you know, this idea, there's physical mediumship and there's mental mediumship, but the state of trance that happens is a continuum in either of those kinds. So to call someone a trance medium, that's not really an accurate way to think about it, because different mediums at different times during different events are in various stages of trance. So there's a lot of problems with language. And so trying to teach people like, oh, you may have heard this, you may have, you know, heard someone say clairvoyant, but it seems that the mediumship process is actually a multimodal situation where the medium see and hear and feel and smell and taste. And so people can, we can just normalize all of this stuff, I think, is the sort of the bottom line of anything is, you know, here's what we know. You know, this 122 mediums talked about their experiences during psychic readings for the living, and they experienced dead people as part of that experience. So this idea of that dead people are with mediumship and no dead people are with psychic, like, no, there seems to be overlap. And the way that we use terminology to like delineate things does not seem appropriate. And we have to, you know, at the end of the day, all we can do is ask people about their experiences. And then we have to study that. We have to take, we have to realize that the experience is important in and of itself. Like I saw a family on TV the other day, and they had a child who he was one of seven kids in the world who had the specific disease that he had. That disease is worth studying. Even if it was one kid, that disease is worth studying. But this idea of mediumship, which is a relatively common, right? Like with our limited email list and Facebook following, we were able to get 1,300 people to answer all of these survey questions. And so there are a lot of mediums in the world is what that, and especially we know, you know, these were US mediums. So there's a lot of mediums in the country. And that they should be, their experiences should be studied because it's a really different experience than our daily, day-to-day life that we have, that most of us have. And so that it's an interesting, mechanism to study the potential of human consciousness.
Oh, it's more than interesting. It's much more than interesting. You make a marvelous case right there for, I mean, if anyone stumbles across this and says, oh, wow, you know, research on mediums, you know, you just kind of brought it into focus in such a wonderful way in terms of how there are so many just basic questions there that we don't have the answer to, we should have the answer to, everyone should care about. And it's just, again, amazing that our broader scientific community isn't interested in this, but we have to be glad that you and Mark are and that Winbridge is. So it's great to have you on again and to talk about all this. And I hope people do follow up and check out your website and follow your work because you've just made an awesome case of how important it really is.
Well, thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Julie Bischel for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess I'd have one question to tee up from this interview. And that is, what is the future of medium research? Or maybe what should be the future of medium research? Is it enough to stick to the practical issues of grief and all the problems our culture has created around dying? Certainly a lot to unpack there, but is that enough? Or should we be looking deeper at some fundamental questions that mediumship raises about science and the nature of consciousness? I guess I'm a little torn on that, and I'd like to hear what you have to say. So the best place, of course, to do that is through the Skeptico website, skeptiko.com, and you can jump on over to the forum or leave a comment there or send in some kind of email. All the shows on the Skeptico website are there, accessible, available for free for download. So do check that out. I have a number of interesting shows coming up, more videos too. Do stick around for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.